Let's get started, Scott, with what's going on in the Middle East right now, Anthony Blinken's visit and the outcome of this visit, and how, what is he trying to do in your opinion?
I think we're involved in a very delicate balancing act taking place that's designed to do a couple of things. Preserve Benjamin Netanyahu's political viability as the Israeli prime minister, and prevent a broader regional conflict. What makes this difficult is that in order for Benjamin Netanyahu to retain viability, he has to be seen as A, being a wartime leader, and B, pursuing policies designed to win wars, not acknowledge defeat. The Americans who are pushing for a ceasefire are pushing for an outcome, a ceasefire, that would be the political ruin of Benjamin Netanyahu. So to offset the political consequences of accepting a ceasefire, which I believe eventually Israel will have to do, Netanyahu is engaged in very dangerous provocations regionally that promote him as an aggressive defender of Israeli security. This is why he carried out the assassinations in Beirut and in Tehran. And this is why Israel continues to carry out aggressive bombing attacks in Lebanon, Syria, and elsewhere. This allows Netanyahu to say that I have not surrendered. I am defending Israel's national security, but doing it in a way that doesn't automatically provoke a Hezbollah or Iranian response. I mean, I think most people believe that there will be a Hezbollah or Iranian response. But the fact that it's taken this long implies that both Hezbollah and Iran are weighing the risks associated with such a response and maybe seeking to mitigate the scope and scale of this response in a way that enables them to resolve domestic political criticism that they've allowed Israel to get away with literal murder without provoking Israel to carry out an even larger counterstrike. So it's a very, very delicate game being played that involves domestic Israeli politics, domestic American politics, domestic Iranian politics, domestic Lebanese politics, and good old-fashioned geopolitical posturing.
Yeah. Here is what Anthony Blinken said during this visit, Scott.
The first is to reaffirm the commitment of the United States to Israel's security. That's a commitment that we put into practice virtually every day since October 7th, including when Israel was attacked directly by Iran back in April. In recent weeks, given the heightened tensions, we have deployed additional assets to the region. The purpose of the deployment of these assets is not to provoke aggression, but rather to deter it. To make sure that it doesn't happen, but also to make clear that if it does, we are fully prepared to defend Israel. We've coupled this effort with an intense diplomatic campaign, virtually a global diplomatic campaign, working with countries around the world to send the message strongly to every concerned party not to take any steps that would escalate tensions, that would risk provoking a wider conflict. And this, too, has been something we've been working on from day one since October 7th. It's been one of our primary objectives to prevent the conflict from escalating, from spreading to other places. And so this coupling of our military commitments, our security commitments, with an intense diplomatic campaign is something that I'm pursuing on this trip, again, with the intent of making sure that we deter further conflict, but that we're also clearly prepared to defend against it if it comes. But what's most crucial now is that everyone refrain from taking any actions that could fuel further conflict, escalate tensions, and result in the spreading of violence and conflict.
Yeah. The question is, Scott, when he says that we are ready to defend Israel, but at the end of the day, what's mattered the most is how they are trying to convince Netanyahu to go after some sort of ceasefire, because that would be the main, that would be the most important solution for this conflict in Gaza, not Iran and Israel, because it's a production of this conflict.
First of all, we have to understand that when the United States says that, or when the Biden administration says that America will defend Israel, they mean just that, defend Israel. That does not mean that America will participate in Israeli offensive actions against either Hezbollah or Iran. And I think that's one of the unspoken realities of this situation that the United States is communicating directly to Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel, that the U.S. will be there if Iran chooses to attack Israel, to retaliate for the Israeli assassination that took place in Tehran. But that if Israel chooses to extend its operations into Iran to launch a major counterstrike, that the United States will not participate, that Israel will be very much on its own, that Israel has put itself in this situation and the United States isn't going to get it out of it, that we will defend Israel, but we won't participate in any offensive action. And I think this is a big card that's being played because, throw out an example here. Right after the assassination, Russia flew in many flights of advanced surface-to-air missiles, S-400s, electronic warfare equipment, radars, etc., that have significantly upgraded Iran's defensive capabilities. This changes everything about the Israeli attack profile. Whatever attack plan that Israel had to strike Iran now has to be significantly modified to take into account these new weapon systems. And Israel may, in fact, not have the capacity to launch meaningful attacks that can defeat this new enhanced defensive posture of Iran. And so the combination of the United States saying, we're not going to help you out to attack Iran, and Iran upgrading its defense has hampered Israel's response potential, limited their options. And so this is something that all parties are taking into account, to include, I believe, Iran, which will seek to strike Israel. Iran must, but will do so in a way that doesn't create an imperative that Israel must respond meaningfully, that hopefully that this thing can go away, just like what happened in April when Israel attacked the Iranian consulate in Damascus. Iran responded, and then Israel did a token retaliation, and that was the end of it. I think all parties are hopeful that that can be the outcome of this current crisis.
And how do you see the mind of Netanyahu and his administration right now? But it seems you say that the United States is saying that we are not going to be part of any sort of attack on Iran. But in the mind of Netanyahu and his administration, it doesn't seem to be like that. They're thinking that if something big happens, the United States will be part of that operation. That's why they're not trying to negotiate, despite everything coming from the, I don't know if you accept that Antony Blinken is doing his best to convince Netanyahu or not, but at the end of the day, one of the main reasons that they're not considering any sort of ceasefire because they're thinking that if something happens between Iran and Israel, the United States would be part of this.
I don't know how Israel can believe that. I believe that Israel was set straight when Netanyahu visited the United States. He got his massive, rounds of standing ovations, 54 or something of that nature, in Congress. But then he had to go and be briefed on reality by the Pentagon and by the White House, where I believe both the Pentagon and the White House put him on notice that America will defend but will not participate in offensive actions. And I think this is what prompted Netanyahu to authorized the assassinations, because he had to do something. He stood before Congress and promised massive strikes against Hezbollah, massive strikes against Iran. But when he was told that this was impossible because the United States wouldn't respond, he didn't back away. He simply refocused his efforts, carried out these assassinations, which were terribly provocative, terribly provocative. The United States could not have been happy with this, but it allowed Netanyahu to posture and say, I am the national security prime minister. I am the leader of Israel that's capable of carrying out these decisive strikes. I have sent a signal to Hezbollah, Hamas, and Iran that Israel will not be trifled with. So he gained some political ammunition domestically by doing that. And that, when combined with the fact that the United States Congress anointed him as the ultimate Israeli leader that America relies upon, I think positions him to be able to consider to enter into negotiations about a ceasefire. But Netanyahu is not just going to roll over. He is looking to maximize his political viability. He has to be careful, because if he accepts a ceasefire that is seen as surrender by his coalition, then his coalition collapses and he may not stay on as prime minister, even though he has the American flag wrapped around his shoulder. So he is going to continue to play this very dangerous game of escalation management, up until which time either he gets a deal that's acceptable or he reaches the end. And the danger here is that if he pushes it too far, then you get an Iranian retaliation, then you get a Hezbollah retaliation, then you get a regional war, and that's an option that nobody wants.
And as you mentioned, do you think that part of this strategy on Iranian strategy toward the considering the response that they're going to have, do you think that because of the way that they're thinking, that these negotiations that are going on between the United States and Israelis in order to have a political settlement, do you think Iran is still hoping that it's going to have something coming out of these negotiations, or that's why they're just not attacking Israel right now? They didn't respond so far. And because everybody's asking why Iran is taking too much time to respond.
Well, what are Iran's strategic objectives here? To be seen as a nation capable of responding to Israel militarily? They've already proven that. Iran is a nation that has a strategic objective not of defining its role in the Middle East through military supremacy. Iran's military power is meant to be a deterrence against outside aggression against Iran. Iran wants to be a geopolitical player that focuses more on its economic potential and its ability to leverage this economic potential into, regional, not dominance, but to be a player regionally. And the region we're talking about is not just the Middle East, but Eurasia. Iran is focused on BRICS, joining BRICS, preparing for BRICS. Iran is focused on the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Iran is focused on a European Economic Union. Iran is focused on everything but war. It doesn't want a war. It's not seeking a war. You remember, Iran didn't ask for this crisis. This crisis was brought on Iran by Israel, that opted to carry out an assassination in Tehran. And so now the question for Iran is, do we, go with our emotions and bomb and throw away all this potential we have of economic revitalization, geopolitical relevance, or are we patient? And do we play this thing out, managing escalation so as not to create a regional conflict that undoes decades of work that Iran has been involved in trying to position itself to be right where it is, a nation on the cusp of geopolitical relevance, reemerging into the family of nations as a major player. This is a role that Iran believes it deserves, it warrants, but it hasn't been able to achieve because of, decades of sanctions and isolation. They're now have the potential to break out of this. Do they really want to be dragged back down into the morass simply because people say we have to bomb Israel? I think Iran's playing this very smart. And I say the same thing for Hezbollah. Hezbollah is no longer just a resistance movement. It is a political party that plays a very important role in Lebanon. And Hezbollah is invested a lot of political capital into getting to this position where the Lebanese people trust Hezbollah to do that which is right, not just for the Shia, not just for Hezbollah, but for Lebanon as a whole. So it's not in Hezbollah's interest to engage in a major confrontation with Israel that would drag Lebanon into this conflict and do tremendous harm on Lebanon at a time when Lebanon simply can't afford to have harm done to it. So again, Hassan Nasrallah is showing his maturity as a leader, a Lebanese leader who has, you know, regional geopolitics on the mind by not drastically escalating in response to Israel's provocation of the assassination in Beirut.
Can we say that this attack, this problem that you're witnessing between Gazans and Israel is unifying all of the parties? Because the news shows that it seems that in Lebanon, the situation, the position of Hezbollah is getting better and better. They were not in the same position before this conflict started between Israel and Gazans.
Could you say that one more time, please?
The position of Hezbollah right now in Lebanon, because you look at Sunni, Shia, and all these parties within Lebanon, it seems all of them are supporting Hezbollah right now, which wasn't the case before this conflict started.
Well, this is what I was saying, that Hezbollah has emerged as a political power in Lebanon, not just the representative of Hezbollah interests, but somebody represents the interests of all of Lebanon. And I think the maturity of Hassan Nasrallah in approaching this issue, focusing on what is best for promoting Palestinian interests, which ultimately mean promoting the creation of a Palestinian state without destroying Lebanon in the process. I think the Lebanese people recognize that the role he has played, the role that Hezbollah has played, has been a very positive one for Lebanon and the region. And this is why you see Christians, Sunni, even Shia factions, Druze, rallying around Hezbollah, saying, we support you in this endeavor.
And the other country that is important is Egypt right now. It seems that they're having some difficulties with the United States and Israel, considering the Philadelphia corridor. And how do you see the situation of this, and why Israelis are doing this? Does it make sense in your opinion?
Well, the Israelis are doing this from a security perspective. They believe that Egypt has failed in its responsibility of policing the border between Egypt and Gaza. There's every reason to believe that Hamas has a lot of connectivity, underground connectivity between Gaza and Egypt that has been used to funnel in weapons and supplies. One of the reasons why Hamas has been able to sustain this 10-month long conflict. And Israel believes that Egypt has done a very poor job. And so Israel's position is if there's going to be a ceasefire, we have to ensure that Hamas does have the ability to reconstitute its forces, because that would just bring us back to square one. And so Israel's demanding that, insisting that it retain control of the Philadelphia corridor, which is a direct violation of the Camp David peace accords. And Egypt is from a legal standpoint saying Israel has no right to do this. But the fact is Egypt's in a difficult position because it hasn't done a good job of policing that corridor. And the question is, was this incompetence? Was this a deliberate oversight on their part? We don't know. Only the Egyptian government knows. But this puts the Egyptian government in a very, very difficult position.
Is the situation in Israel helping the Biden administration in 2024, considering the Democratic Party? If not, why they're not trying to do the maximum thing that they can do in order to convince Netanyahu?
I mean, that's a political question that the Biden administration is weighing right now. On the one hand, in the America of today, it's impossible for a major political player to seek national office, especially the presidency, without bowing before the shrine of Israel. And you see the Biden administration doing that. You see Kamala Harris saying the same thing. She would do that. Trump is doing that. RFK Jr. Was doing that. The only one who's not doing that is Jill Stein and Cornel West, I guess. You know, but to be honest, while I respect their respective positions, you know, they aren't going to win the election. But on the other hand, you know, especially in the Democratic Party, there are important demographics in critical, you know, states, you know, battleground states, especially Michigan, Wisconsin, that have taken such offense at the Biden administration's, you know, support of Israel's genocide, the facilitation of the continued murder of Palestinian children and civilians by Israel using American bombs, that, you know, the posture of the Biden administration vis-a-vis Israel could cost them these states. So it's a very difficult position for Biden. And what makes it even more difficult is that if Biden softens, or if Kamala Harris softens her position on Gaza, takes a more conciliatory posture towards the Palestinian cause, you know, she's going to lose, you know, pro-Israeli voters who will just jump over to Trump, because for pro-Israeli voters, you know, it doesn't matter so much the D or the R. What matters is Israel and which side is going to, you know, best support Israel. So it's a very difficult position for the Biden administration to be in right now. And this is one of the reasons why I think you see Anthony Blinken, you know, in the Middle East, in Israel, working hard to try and get some sort of ceasefire, because the sooner they can get a ceasefire, the sooner they can say, look, we did everything we could to bring an end to this war, but we did it in a way that Israel, the state of Israel, agrees with. And so it'll be the best of both worlds for the Biden administration.
Is Netanyahu thinking that he's winning the conflict? That's why he's not willing to negotiate. He's not willing to have any sort of political settlement. Or is it something else in his mind that he's seeking?
I don't think Netanyahu thinks he's winning militarily. I think he knows the opposite. I think he is seeking to survive politically. I think this entire posturing by Israel is about Netanyahu's continued political survival. And the shame is that he's putting, you know, not just the existential survival of Israel on the table, but he's putting, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of Palestinian lives on the table, just because he wants his political legacy to be that of a leader that isn't tainted by corruption charges, isn't tainted by military defeat. He wants to emerge from this crisis as the savior of Israel. And I think that's what's driving him, not some artificial belief that Israel's winning, but the necessity to sell an Israeli victory to an Israeli public, even if it isn't necessarily the victory that Netanyahu originally promised.
If we compare Russia and Israel during these two conflicts, we can say definitely that Russian army is getting stronger, stronger, and more strategically thinking than. But how about the Israeli army? Are they getting stronger, in your opinion?
I don't believe so. I think the Israeli army is getting weaker. Materially, they're exhausted. They've run out of spare parts for their tanks and armored vehicles, so they can't repair damaged vehicles, which means that they are depleting their frontline stocks and having to replace them with, you know, older mothballed equipment, which is a reduction in capability. Their military, you know, isn't designed to fight a 10-month-long war. They're designed to fight shorter conflicts, conflicts that have less emphasis on infantry-on-infantry engagements and more emphasis on exploiting technological supremacy on the part of Israel in terms of the tech, you know, the equipment they bring to bear, most of it provided by the United States. You know, Israel is morally exhausted. You know, the most moral army in the world has turned out not to be, turned out to be actually an army of genocidal murderers, rapists. You know, not all Israeli soldiers behave in this way, but a significant number do. And now what we're finding out is that there's a significant element in Israeli society that supports this kind of behavior, which creates a moral dilemma for Israel itself as it looks to the world to say, you know, we need the world's support to continue to survive. And the world is looking at Israel saying, we can't support you, and we probably never will, as you're currently configured. So the idea that Israel today is stronger than it was on October 6th, I think, is ludicrous. Israel is far weaker.
The other thing that Iranians are talking about, fighter jets, buying fighter jets from Russia. Do you think that if that happens, what would happen to the situation between Iran and Israel? Are we going to have the tension's going to increase or decrease, in your opinion?
I mean, Israel has long said that it doesn't support Russia providing, equipment that is the equivalent of that which is provided by the United States to Israel or close to it. But, you know, Israel has created a situation where Russia almost has no other option, because Israel's behavior is so egregious. The assassination of, a senior Hamas official in Tehran, a Hamas official, by the way, who was leading the negotiations to bring about a ceasefire. And then, Israel, this kind of brazen behavior demands a response. And as Russia's Lavrov warned Israel, Russia will not sit on the sidelines forever. And so Russia now has gotten off the sidelines and is in the process of upgrading Iran's military capability, which will complicate any potential future conflict between Israel and Iran to the detriment of Israel.
They were telling Iran that don't attack Israel because we are negotiating right now. Just be prepared. We're going to have an agreement. And Qataris were talking about this. Washington was talking about this. But at the end of the day, do you think that we are all prisoners of Netanyahu's position? That's why they cannot convince him, because if he loses his position, that would be dangerous for him. That's why he has to continue this war, and nobody's able, even these Arab states, together with the United States, together with the tensions, growing tensions between Iran and Israel, all of them together are not capable of convincing Netanyahu.
Again, Netanyahu, what are you trying to convince him of? Political defeat? Because this is what, if Netanyahu concedes and accepts a peace plan, that can be spun as an Israeli defeat, and it would be spun as an Israeli defeat by Netanyahu's political opponents and even Netanyahu's political allies, who are looking for a military victory promised by Netanyahu. That's the end of Netanyahu politically. And given the fact that he has a number of corruption charges hanging over his head, it's the end of Netanyahu. It's the end of his life. So this is all about Netanyahu. And I think the United States and others recognize this, and this is why everybody's working so hard to come up with some sort of solution that gets what the Palestinians insist on, which is a pathway towards a Palestinian state, while allowing Netanyahu with a graceful exit to say, I stood up for the defense of Israel, and now I can bow out gracefully, not leave with the tail between the legs. It's a very, almost an impossible juggling game. But it's the one that they're being played, because Netanyahu has put his own personal ambition above that of what's best for the state of Israel.
If you were to assess what Saudi Arabia and UAE are doing to help Gazans, what would you point out in terms of this assessment?
I don't think the Arab world is helping Gaza at all. I think they're betraying Gaza. Right now, you have the Saudis talking about that from their position, maybe the most beneficial path for regional stability is normalization with Israel. That would be the legitimization of genocide, of murder of the Palestinians. You have important Saudi influencers, talking about the Palestinians as, a non-existent state, a non-existent people. The same thing with many of the Gulf Arab states. So I think this is the unfortunate reality of the Palestinians, that they have been betrayed consistently by their Arab neighbors. The only Arabs that are on their side appears to be, Hezbollah, Syria, and the Iraqis. But, you know, in terms of the Gulf Arab states, the Palestinian cause has been betrayed from day one, and it continues to be betrayed today.
And how about the European Union? We know that the European Union trying to be silent, but at the end of the day, they're not happy with what's going on in Gaza. But what was the outcome of their policy so far, in your opinion?
I mean, they put, you know, indirect pressure on Israel, but not direct pressure. You know, you see some political posturing by certain EU states by recognizing a Palestinian state. But other than the moment that it happens on TV and people cheering, it doesn't accomplish anything. The bombs are still dropping. People are still dying. You have the International Court of Justice making some very important decisions regarding Israel and genocide. And the European Union's not acting on those, as although they're empowered to do so, to hold Israel accountable. You have the International Criminal Court designating Netanyahu as a war criminal, arrest warrant out there, but no one seems to be pushing for, the fulfillment of that arrest warrant. So there's a lot of political posturing by Europe that is designed to make them look good on paper, but the reality is they aren't supporting the Palestinian people, because every day Israeli bombs continue to fall and murder Palestinian children and Palestinian civilians, and Europe's not doing anything meaningfully to stop that.
Yeah. Before shifting to the conflict in Ukraine, Scott, what's going on between UN and FBI right now? What's the latest information on this case?
I have no update other than what I've reported since August 7th. I've had no communication with the U.S. government. Nobody's called me. Nobody sent me a letter. Nobody's responded to my queries. So I'm in a waiting mode.
Yeah, because everybody's asking what's going on, and we didn't know really what's going on, as you mentioned that. And how about the latest comment of Lavrov on the case of this attack, this offensive on the Kursk region? He said, with this offensive, with this invasion of Ukraine's invasion of Russia, we cannot negotiate with Zelensky and his administration. Or he said Kiev, he means everybody from Ukraine.
Well, according to some media reports, there were back channel negotiations taking place, I believe, in Qatar, between Ukraine, Russia, maybe using intermediaries, maybe not directly, but some dialogue designed to, find a mutually acceptable diplomatic off-ramp. If, as we remember, Vladimir Putin put a peace plan on the table back in June and said, this is the peace plan that we're running with. Ukraine rejected it, but the West rejected Ukraine's rejection. And so there seemed to be some effort to find, a common acceptable way to end this conflict. Russia never bought into that. I think Russia always said, we never closed the door on discussions, but it doesn't mean that Russia was desperately searching for an end. Russia understands that it has the momentum, that it has the strategic advantage in this conflict. It's getting stronger. Ukraine's getting weaker. But Russia's also aware that this conflict could spin out of control at any minute, given the political investment that the West has made in a Ukrainian victory that isn't going to happen. And so, Russia, in looking for an end game, is looking how to balance the ego of the West to avoid unnecessary escalation. So it's a very, we'll just call it a very political environment taking place. That's over. The Ukrainian invasion of Kursk, which is an invasion of Russia on behalf of NATO, even though both NATO and the United States deny their involvement, this simply could not have happened without a significant involvement. This has terminated the negotiations. And now all that's left is the strategic defeat of Israel, of Ukraine, which will happen on a timetable that Russia is in charge of. you know, Russia is not going to sacrifice men needlessly. Russia is prevailing on the battlefield, even in Kursk. The Ukrainian offensive is stopped. The strategic reserves that were committed are being hunted down and destroyed as we speak. The Russians did not divert significant forces to respond to Kursk. They maintained the momentum in Donetsk, and they're on the cusp of a major, major victory in the Donbas, in Zaporizhia, as the Ukrainian forces reach the point of collapse, meaning that the defenses are breached, there's nothing behind them. There's some talk that the Ukraine will order the remaining forces in Donbas to fight to the death to delay Russia while Ukraine seeks to rebuild a defensive line on the west bank of the Dnieper River and then leave those forces to die, that are east of that river. This is an act of desperation. This is where, Russia is. And, so I think that's where we're at right now. We are looking at a strategic Russian victory. We're looking at a Ukraine that has run out of options because they basically threw their strategic reserves into this gambit in Kursk that has failed. And we're looking at a West that is watching everything that they've struggled to achieve over the course of the past, not just 2+ years of conflict, but remember, the Ukrainian gambit is something that began in 2008 when they invited Ukraine. It's part and parcel of an overall strategic policy designed to leverage Ukraine into a tool capable of weakening Russia. The West is waking up to the reality that this has failed, and now they're left with this strong Russia, stronger than it was before this conflict started, emboldened by this victory over not just Ukraine, but the collective West, and angry at the West. From the Western perspective, this is a very dangerous situation, and you see confusion in Europe, in NATO, in the United States on how to respond to this. Just to show you how dangerous this is, the United States back in March modified its nuclear employment plan. That means using nuclear weapons. They modified their nuclear employment plan to factor in the new Russian reality, the new North Korean reality, the new Chinese reality. We're talking about the use of nuclear weapons. And when you say modify or update, it means that we have new war plans that envision the use of nuclear weapons against Russia under conditions that are evolving. This is a very, very dangerous situation. When Apti Aladanov, the Chechen Russian commander currently in Kursk, says either the war ends this year or we face World War III, he's not exaggerating. This is a very, very dangerous situation that we are confronted with.
The other thing that Zelensky is asking for, long-range missiles and the permission to attack Russia, do you think that if, as you mentioned, this offensive is failing right now, but how about getting nuclears, using dirty nuclear bombs, using these long-range missiles against Russia?
I don't see Ukraine using a dirty nuclear bomb. That would be just as foolish as can be. I can't see Ukraine getting any support for the use of a dirty bomb. Anybody who's studied dirty bombs, and I have, we researched when I was a weapons inspector in Iraq. We investigated, an Iranian dirty bomb and its potential. It's just not a very good weapon. One of the interesting things is that the Iranians reached the same conclusion in pursuing this weapon. They did all the studies, and they went, it's a lot of effort to produce something that doesn't kill that many people. It's not that effective. So I just don't see Ukraine going that route. I see a lot of rhetoric about this designed to gin up emotions, but the bigger threat is long range weapons. And if the United States does provide some of these standoff weapons that you're talking about, I think people need to start listening to Russia. Russia won't tolerate this. Russia won't tolerate Ukraine striking deep inside to Russia, because Russia recognizes that this isn't Ukraine doing this. This is NATO and the United States doing this, and Russia will respond accordingly. And increasingly the conversations that senior Russian politicians and senior Russian military officers have is that if NATO seeks to use Ukraine as a proxy to carry out long-range strikes inside Russia, that Russia will respond directly against NATO. And I mean, I'll get a conversation I had yesterday that I think will air tonight, the Scott Ritter Show. The senator said that this will probably include using nuclear weapons against European states. He threatened Great Britain in particular, said we'll just remove England from the world's map. This is an active senator, a lieutenant general, retired, who has the ear of Vladimir Putin. And I've seen Russian military officers say the same thing. Russia's just not in the business of absorbing blows indefinitely from the West. And, you know, if Russia believes that if NATO takes that step to promote long-range strike inside Russia, that means that they've made a decision to decisively engage Russia down the road. And Russia's just not going to sit back and let NATO create an environment that maximizes their striking power and minimizes Russia's ability. Russia will preemptively strike using nuclear weapons. That's the world we live in. I mean, and this is the data that's out there, and nobody's doing anything about it. Everybody's pretending as if this is not a big deal, as if this is, you know, a bluff on the part of Russia. It's not.
There are the right-wing party, the party that believes that Russia has to respond more solidly and strongly. Do you think that they're winning over Putin's rhetoric, the way that Putin had managed during this conflict? Do you think that there are putting some sort of pressure on Putin and his decisions toward the West, toward Ukraine?
Who's putting pressure on Putin?
These people, right-wing parties who are more radical, who are more against the West, against the policies of the of NATO.
No, I think Vladimir Putin is the head of the, you know, I mean, he's been the head of Russia for close to a quarter of a century now. He's very much in charge. I think he listens to people, to points of view. But the idea that you can pressure Putin, especially, you know, on issues of national security, that's just not how Russia works. The Russian president doesn't respond to pressure. He responds to facts. He responds to reality. He absorbs this information and he makes decisions based upon that information. But the idea that the Russian president, look, he just won an election in March that solidified his position. You don't win it with those margins only to turn around and say, well, I'm politically susceptible to pressure from far right parties. No, the far right parties have no pressure, no ability to pressure Vladimir Putin. Putin will make the decisions that he believes are best in the best interest of the Russian Federation.
Don't you think that the way Putin is responding to any sort of escalation is just perceiving, the West is perceiving this attitude as he's afraid of us. He's afraid of escalation. He's afraid of, that's why we don't have any sort of negotiation. They don't want Russia to be at the table to negotiate with. They don't want to do anything politically, just sending weapons, more aids to Ukraine so far. And we see the same type of attitude so far from Putin and his administration, just going on and on. How do you make sense of this attitude on part of Putin? And don't you think that he's getting to the point that his patience is perceived in the West as his weakness?
I think both the Russian president, the Russian leadership, and frankly speaking, the Russian people just don't care about the West anymore. They don't care what you think. They don't care what I think. They don't care what anybody thinks in the West. They're done with the West. The notion that Russia needs to do things to convince a Western audience about what the truth is absurd. Russia only needs to do things that, you know, promote Russia's interests. You know, Putin only plays to a Russian audience. He is only responsive to a Russian audience. He does have to balance in the consideration of the rest of the world. And this is one of the reasons why you see such a pragmatic, patient, responsible leader, because he is demonstrating to the numerous nations that are rallying around the BRICS forum that Russia is a responsible player. It's not Russia's job to convince the West that Russia's serious. And I think that's the problem, is that in the West, we're like, well, Russia's not explaining things to us. Therefore, we start to read into it. That means that Putin's scared. Putin's this, Putin's that. I think it just means that Putin doesn't care. It's not his job to make you and I comfortable with what Russia's doing. The day and age where Russia cares about Western public opinion, Western political opinion, is long past. They care about the global South. They care about China. They care about India. But they don't care about the United States and Europe anymore.
Don't you think that Ukraine is going to be a continuous problem for Russia if they continue this attitude of attacking on the Russian territory, this type of just bombing civilian areas? That's why I think that Russia has a path to communicate with the European Union, at least to have some sort of, to solve this problem that we call it right now is Ukraine. And without having any political settlement on Ukraine, they have to focus on their economy and other things. But with Ukraine having on your border and having all of these problems, how you can manage that?
Well, first of all, the idea that Russia can view Europe as a reliable partner, because to engage with Europe means that you hope to achieve something beneficial from this engagement. Europe's just shown itself to be liars. Going back to Minsk, when François Hollande, the French president, and Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, lied to Putin, saying, no, we are promoting peace. But they later admitted, no, Minsk was just a sham to buy time to give NATO a chance to build the Ukrainian army that it can more effectively confront Russia. I don't know why the West doesn't understand that once France and Germany does that, that Russia will never again trust them. The United States has repeatedly lied to Russia about arms control, about a number of things. Russia no longer trusts the United States. It's not a reliable partner. So the idea that Putin is looking to Europe to save the day, to come in and do the right thing by Ukraine, is absurd. I always remind people, you have to listen to the words of the Russian president. And one speech I would advise everybody to go back and reread is the speech that Putin gave on the eve of initiating the special military operation, when he talked about the history of Ukraine. And he did so again in his interview with Tucker Carlson, which people rolled their eyes. They called it Russian propaganda. Read it again, because it tells you everything about where Russia is right now. I'll just shorten it. Ukraine is a historical mistake. It's a mistake made by Lenin, and Russia is going to fix this mistake. I'll say it one more time so people understand what I'm saying. The only reason why Ukraine exists is because of a political mistake made by Lenin, and Russia is now going to correct this mistake. That means Ukraine isn't going to exist when this is done. You keep saying that Ukraine's going to be there, this festering wound, this constant problem. No, it won't. Ukraine isn't going to exist when this is done. Whatever we call Ukraine today isn't going to exist. It's going to be something else. And for that, you can thank Ukraine for invading Russia. You can thank the West for facilitating this invasion. Vladimir Putin had a plan on the table back in June that envisioned a Ukraine that retained Odessa, Kharkov, Sumy, Dnepropetrovsk, Nikolaev. These are territories that many in Russia are saying have to be Russian. And the plan put on the table by Putin said, no, this will be Ukraine. Putin was talking about an independent Ukraine. It had to be neutral. It couldn't have a NATO army in it. And the Banderist ideology had to be eliminated. But Ukraine was going to be an independent state. I don't think they're talking in that language anymore. They speak of the Kiev regime, eliminating the Kiev regime. They're no longer talking about Ukraine as a nation state, because I think their goal and objective is that when this is done, there will be no Ukrainian nation state.
When it comes to the Washington and their policy right now, I'm going to play a clip here, Scott.
The Ukrainians, in terms of their focus, you heard President Zelensky say it was to create a buffer zone. So we're having those conversations to learn more about what their objectives are. Again, if you take a step back from a U.S. perspective, our focus continues to be enabling Ukraine to be a free and sovereign country that can deter Russian aggression in the future. And so that continues to be our focus. As it relates to their operation in Kursk, as I mentioned, they clearly have compelled the Russians to struggle in their response. It has certainly demonstrated the creativity and the battlefield prowess of the Ukrainians. But when it comes to what their longer term objectives are here, that's something that we're still discussing with them. Thank you. Sure.
Yeah, he's talking about creativity of Ukrainians in terms of this attack and how they're going to support Ukraine. In your opinion, do they have any sort of a strategy right now with what's going on between Russia and Ukraine? Or just trying to convince the press that we are going to support Ukraine for I don't know, for how many years they have in their mind?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to look at what Ukraine was attempting to do with this Kursk incursion. They were seeking to take significant territory, inclusive of the Kursk nuclear power plant, to seize this territory, to get what they basically called, I forget the exact term, but, it's basically to get chips on the table that they can trade for the chips that Russia has. To say, we'll give you back Kursk and the Kursk nuclear power plant in exchange for the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant and Kherson, something of that nature, an exchange that could allow Zelensky then to seek a ceasefire on terms that showed, look, he pushed Russia back. This is deterrence to Russia. That was one objective. The other one was to get the Russians to divert significant military resources from their ongoing offensive operations in the Donbas, and effectively halting those operations at the moment when they're having the greatest success, and diverting these resources to deal with the Kursk incursion. So that was the goal and objective. And, you know, from a Western standpoint, that's those are strategic objectives. Now the West is confronted with the reality that one, the Ukrainians didn't come anywhere near the Kursk nuclear power plant. Two, the Kursk gambit is failing. The Russians didn't divert significant resources. They responded with two Marine brigades and the Akhmat special forces that are in the process of hunting down the Ukrainians on Russian soil and killing them. This will take some time. Opti Aladonov, the Chechen general, Russian general in charge of the Akhmat Special Forces, has said this is very difficult fighting. These Ukrainians have, good training. They have good equipment. They have good command and control. They fight using a different standard than any Ukrainian force has ever done before, a NATO standard. Integrating artificial intelligence into the concept of operations, modern communications, etc. But he said, we are winning. We've stopped them, and now we're killing them. That's the reality. So the Ukrainians aren't going to have any chips to trade. What they've done is they've taken their best trained forces, best equipped forces that could have been used to help stabilize the situation in the Donbas, and instead they've expended them in order to save these forces. Now they've had to take additional brigades from the Zaporizhia area and deploy them in to try and, stabilize the collapse of the Ukrainian position in Kursk, further weakening their position in the Donbas. Meanwhile, Russia continues to advance almost unimpeded in the West. We're looking at the veritable collapse of Ukraine defense there. So the Kursk operation has been an absolute failure. Now the West is trying to spin it in a way that, on the one hand, sort of gives the Ukrainians a little pat on the back, saying, good job. But on the other hand, washing their hands of it, saying, you know, we don't know what the strategic goals and objectives of Ukraine are, and we're worried that Ukraine may not have the ability to accomplish that what it's set out to do.
Do we know how many forces they've used for this offensive?
The Russians have said that 18 different units, brigades, separate battalions, regiments, basically the equivalent of two divisions, have been deployed in support of this, with more brigades coming up. So the number of troops is between like 9 and 12,000, with the potential even more being added to the fight. But they've already lost close to 4,000 casualties, dead. And they're losing more. They've lost a tremendous amount of equipment. And so, you know, even if they're able to withdraw, a majority of the remaining bodies back into Ukraine, the equipment that went in with them, the Challenger tanks, the M1 Abrams, the Leopards, the Martyrs, the Bradleys, the Strikers, this equipment's being destroyed. They've basically sacrificed their strategic reserves to achieve, short-term political TikTok videos. It's sort of ironic that the majority of the videos that we saw early on in this conflict, showing Ukrainians going up and taking their photographs at town plates and doing things, the Russians now have responded with videos that either show those people dead or captured. I mean, that's the fate of every Ukrainian that's gone into Kursk, unless they can get out of Kursk. And Russia is not just striking back at Kursk, but they're striking the logistical support hubs and command and control hubs in Sumy province. And they're just devastating. As Ukraine brings up reinforcements, they arrive in Sumy and they're hit by the glide bombs, and they never make it in. So this is just devastating all around for Ukraine.
And how about the percentage of mercenaries, Scott, in this operation? Do we have any sort of information on that?
Well, I don't have an exact number. I do know that the Russians have provided anecdotal evidence that, when they monitor the communication nets, they hear a lot of Polish voices, a lot of French voices, a lot of English voices. But in terms of, the prisoners that they present, the bodies that they show, these are primarily Ukrainians. And so I would guess that you have, for instance, the International Legion that is there, multiple battalions of troops. But the vast majority of the troops that were engaged in this fighting are Ukrainian troops.
And these mercenaries, do you think the majority of them are just fighting for money? Or they're just believing in what they're doing?
It's hard to get into the motivation of a mercenary. I think many of them are just adventurers who have become addicted to war. A lot of the Americans and some of the British are people who volunteered previously to fight against ISIS in Syria on the side of the Syrians. And they've become addicted to war. And so they go there. Others are people who are unsatisfied with their situation at home. Others are military veterans who didn't see combat while they were in, or were in jobs that wouldn't allow them to see combat. And they decided they want to prove their manhood. I can't speak to the motivation of these individuals. I think it changes per person. The money isn't that good. It's not the equivalent of, what a Blackwater operative was earning in Iraq. But, it's a chance to go out and kill Russians. And so that is something that many people find attractive.
And the other thing that Russians were talking about was this, the U.S. journalists in this region. Do you think, what would the motive of this sending journalists to the region, and is that based on international law? Is it against international law? How do you find it?
I think a journalist is a journalist. They do their job. Generally speaking, journalists are held accountable to the laws. Not generally speaking, but in every case, you're held accountable to the laws of the nations you work in. We saw that with Evan Gershkowitz, the Wall Street Journal journalist who claims he was researching a story, but he received classified information and the Russians prosecuted him as a spy. Probably because he was one, but even if he wasn't, he acted like one. You know, from the Russian perspective, you can't enter Russian territory without the permission of the Russian government. And so if you're a journalist who has crossed into Russia as part of this Kursk incursion, you're in violation of Russian law. We can even take it a step further. Some of the units that are operating inside Kursk are units affiliated with the Banderist ideology that Russia has labeled to be criminal units, terrorist units. And so if a journalist has embedded, now they're providing material support for terrorism, and that's another criminal offense that could be put on them. So, you know, journalists have to be careful. Look, we've seen journalists travel to Crimea and have the Ukrainians attack them by saying, you know, you've gone into Ukrainian territory without our permission. I have traveled to Crimea. I have traveled to Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Lugansk, totally in conformity with Russian law. But from the Ukrainian perspective, I'm violating Ukrainian law. So, you know, journalists just have to be careful on what they do and try to ensure that, you know, they're doing their journalistic duties of reporting, you know, the fact-based truth from a ground level.
Just to wrap up this session, Scott, do you see any sort of concern in the European Union with what's going on in this region, with this attack on Russian soil?
Not enough. I've seen the Germans gloating. I mean, it's unbelievable what we see happening in Germany, where German officers dressed in their formal uniforms are, you know, briefing the battle, you know, drawing arrows around Kursk as if they have no, you know, notion of history and, you know, what that battle means. We have, you know, Europeans, you know, gloating about the, you know, Germans again, gloating about having German tanks on Russian soil in Kursk as if this is a good thing. There's not enough concern about the consequences of this action, what it means. This is a very, very dangerous situation. Again, not to overplay my hand, but I have to say it. The fact that Europe shows so little regard for, you know, the reality that Ukraine, operating as a NATO proxy, has invaded Russia and what the consequences of this means, shows the absolute disconnect that exists in Europe between the reality as it exists on the ground in Ukraine and the fantasy that exists, you know, in the heads of these European leaders who have invested everything they have into the notion of an expansive NATO designed to not just confront Russia, but to defeat Russia. And now they are waking up to the reality that Russia has not been defeated. In fact, Russia may very well end up defeating the collective West. At least in Ukraine, but if they want to have an expansive conflict in that as well. And this creates a political problem that politicians can't confront directly, so they'll continue to lie to deceive their respective publics.
If something happens, Scott, we know that that would be, we can say, impossible. But if something happens, is the United States thinking of Europe as a buffer zone that they can, the threshold would be, if the war comes to Europe, we can then negotiate with Russia?
You know, now we're getting into a level of, you know, strategic chicanery that I can't imagine that conversation taking place in the White House Situation Room. It's so grossly irresponsible. You know, I can't imagine the United States openly talking about selling Europe out. When Joe Biden talks about, you know, the sacred duty of the United States to defend Israel, I would imagine that most posturing regarding American support for Israel reflects, you know, that concept. I do think the United States, though, has played games on the margins. For instance, we have long been talking about the need for Germany to liberate itself from, you know, cheap Russian energy, without really taking into account what the consequences of that would be. There are some who say that the United States has, in fact, taken into account that one of the goals was to facilitate the deindustrialization of Germany, to weaken Germany economically so that the United States might have more leverage in Europe through, you know, increased economic presence and influence, replace cheap Russian gas with, you know, expensive American liquid natural gas seemed to be one of the things that was happening here. So I can't say consistently that America's actual policies reflect, you know, the desire to, you know, have the sacred duty of defending Europe. There is some aspect of American policy that does seem to be to the detriment of Europe, and that seems to be part of a strategic objective of the United States to de-emphasize the Eurozone and try to incorporate Europe into, you know, a shrinking dollar zone. So I think there is a balance there, but just to come straight out in a national security meeting and say, we're here to create a buffer zone in Europe, the hell with NATO, the hell with the European Union, just a pure buffer zone. That might be a conversation that takes place in think tanks, but I don't think that's a conversation that takes place in the White House Situation Room.
Again, we're witnessing new articles about Nord Stream pipeline and talking about two Ukrainians. Then they said that the Zaluzhny was behind this attack. Right now they're talking about two Ukrainians. What's the necessity of talking about Nord Stream pipeline right now? And do you think is there anybody buying this argument that the Ukrainians were behind this attack?
I mean, this is a big game that's being played right now. The interesting thing is that Germany has come out and committed to a narrative that says Russia didn't do it. If you remember when Nord Stream first was attacked, one of the big themes that was being promoted is that Russia did this, that the Russians are responsible. And so now Germany, as the primary affected party, has come out and said, no, Russia didn't do this. But now they're pointing the finger at Ukraine. You know, there are people like myself who are doubtful that Ukraine could have pulled this off. But I have to acknowledge, I have not seen the totality of the German data. I don't know what specifics are included in the indictments that they have put forward on some named Ukrainian individuals. So without that, it's impossible to do a full evaluation. But it runs in the face of reporting, for instance, by Seymour Hersh, who is a respected investigative journalist with a long track record of getting it right. And it also ignores the, you know, qui bono, who benefits from this. When you have, you know, Joe Biden saying, if Russia invades Ukraine, we will destroy it. I will destroy the pipeline. When Ted Cruz says, no, this is a good thing. Victoria Nuland praises this, the fact of the matter is the overwhelming amount of circumstantial evidence out there points to the United States being the perpetrator of this act. And so now we see, Germany taking the lead and trying to point the finger to Ukraine. It's interesting. It's fascinating, the timing of it and the content of these accusations. I think there's a lot more at play politically than meets the eye.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Scott, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Well, thanks for having me. And again, I apologize for running late.
Problem at all.